Through a Scottish Prism, the programme that is unapologetically pro-Scottish independence and anti-Westminster rule. Everything we say here is viewed through a Scottish Prism. Brought to you by Barhead Boy.
Welcome to the Prism Show, Alec. Thank you very much for coming back to speak to us. First question, of course, is how are you getting on? How are you enjoying the campaign?
Oh, I'm having a great time. I mean, I got drenched in Edinburgh, talked in Lithgow, and totally drook it in Bowness tonight. these monsoon -4 conditions in Scotland, the height of summer, it's absolutely fantastic, yes. I've never enjoyed myself so much in my life.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, the question, you've done your time in the coalface. I know you like a wee game of golf. You could have been playing golf, doing speaking tours. You could have just had it easy, put your feet up, maybe even bought yourself a pipe. I don't know. Why did you decide to come back in and take on the fight for Scotland again?
Well, do you think I'd play golf in conditions like this? Are you mad?
Well, you're Scottish, we all do. I can't play in that warm weather. I prefer a good gale with a horizontal rain. Carry whack it.
You know the advantages I can get when I'm playing golf. I suppose in 2014 when I handed over the reins to Nicola, I thought things were set fair for the independence movement. And as I said in my book, The Dream Shall Never Die, I thought Scotland had fundamentally changed and therefore it was only a matter of time. You know, I thought the destination was certain and the timing was the only thing in question. But I have to say, I mean, we're 7 years on. I'm beginning to wonder if the timescale that's being arrived at is one which fits with my 3 score years and 10, you know. I'm beginning to get a bit anxious that the degree of procrastination is going to steal the time from all of us. So I don't like to be critical because I know what how difficult it is to be First Minister. I know it's a tough, challenging job, and I know that the issues at the moment, and particularly that occurs over the last year with unprecedented pandemic, well, we're certainly unprecedented for a century. I don't understand why that doesn't mean that even the preparations can't be laid for independence. Mm-hmm. And it's painfully obvious there have been virtually no preparations, no thinking, no strategic moves, and it's almost as if the independence case has been left static since 2014. Well, the world has changed since 2014, and the independence case has to change with it. And if we're going to seek a referendum, then we better get on with it. And if we're going to win a referendum, then we better get the platform into being. So it was more and obviously I was approached by 5 political parties, nonetheless, to either stand for them or to lead them. And I thought that the ALAPA proposal from Laurie Flynn was by far the best of these. And I was persuaded that we should give it a chance to fly from the runway.
And we're glad you did. Very glad you did. It's been difficult because ALBA have been frozen out by the broadcasters, as we know. I mean, and then recently, of course, last week we had BBC Wales with some guy we'd never heard of from leading some party we'd never heard of with a tiny percentage of the poll on a BBC debate. But of course, ALAPA and your good self have been excluded. That must have been extremely frustrating for you.
Well, of course, I mean, that person we never heard of was trying to abolish the Synod, abolish the Welsh Assembly. I suppose the message from the BBC is if you're trying to abolish the Welsh Assembly, then they'll tell you to usher you into the debate. If you're trying to abolish the Westminster Parliament, they'll try and freeze you out. I mean, look, the BBC, I have issues with other broadcasters. I think they should have given ALAPA a much fairer deal. Probably with the sole exception of Bauer Radio, which I think has been extremely fair. But with that exception, the other broadcasters could have done more, but at least Sky and STV have made an effort. The only people who have made no effort at all are Channel 4, who are a total disgrace to their public service ethos, and the BBC, who are a total outrage. And so it's quite interesting that the worst people in terms of abiding by precepts of democracy, freedom of speech, and facilitating political debate are the two companies which have a public service obligation. And that indicates to me that both of them, whatever they pretend to be, are not public service broadcasters, they're state broadcasters. And the actions of Channel 4, or the inactions rather, and the BBC much more so, are basically because they toe the state line, just as they did in 2014. And the BBC seems to exist to defend the British state. And it's not just, of course, that what they do in terms of freezing out Alapa. If you look at the... In 2017, Ofcom, who regulate broadcasters and now regulate the BBC, had a discussion paper, which was quite a good discussion paper. I actually contributed or influenced the contributions, let's put it that way, where they said the concept of major parties was no longer relevant because there was new parties emerging. And they were thinking of Brexit, UKIP and all that sort of thing, as well as the national situation in Scotland and Wales, Northern Ireland. And saying, look, we shouldn't be confined to the major parties, Labour, Tory, Liberal, Democrats. We should be thinking beyond that. And so they abolished that definition. Well, lo and behold, the BBC in Scotland still have it. You know, even though the BBC submitted to that consultation and said, no, that's, you know, agreed that that was old-fashioned, the BBC in Scotland still adhere to that. And so they have the five parties, which are... the three unionists, you know, Ragtag and Bobtail, that's Tory, Labour and Lib Dems, they've got the SNP and the Greens. And they say they should get comparable coverage. But if you look at that and think about it, the SNP are 10 times the size of Liberal Democrats. You know, the SNP have got 50%, Liberal Democrats have got 5%. The SNP have got, you know, 60 MSPs more or less, and the Liberal Democrats have got 5. And yet they get the same time as the SNP. It just shows how ludicrous it is. I mean, this is a system designed to prop up Willie Rennie. I mean, it's ludicrous. I mean, somebody who has absolutely nothing to say of any worth about anything, apart from perhaps his long-standing campaign about mental health, which I support. But otherwise, Liberal Democrats are totally irrelevant. And yet they're treated as if they're a major force in the land. So even within the terms of the, quote, five major parties are wrong. But to exclude Alapa, you know, who in seven opinion polls would have parliamentary representation in a tight situation, have to a great extent dictated the terms of the election, particularly in its initial stages, to make sure that independence would be the issue, is a total and utter outrage. And I think we're long past thinking this is a, you know, a group of people getting together at the BBC and having a long ponder about how they can ensure balance and fairness. This is just state power. We're not going to let these people on because they're a threat to the British state. And unfortunately, of course, nobody would believe that Patrick Harvey was a threat to anything, never mind the British state. And I'm afraid to say that the SNP, in terms of their attitude to timescale, it is such that the BBC probably think they can comfortably accommodate them in the pantheon of British political parties. So Alapa has been singled out for rough treatment because they don't like our politics.
That's exactly
the opposite of what the BBC are meant to be about.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, I think the SNP should be warned. I mean, the Andrew Marr show on Sunday had just unionists on and they excluded the SNP. So what goes around comes around.
They're very fortunate, of course. You're absolutely right. They're very fortunate that the SNP government at the present moment, because the unionists are so inept. I mean, I've never seen opposition parties as inept as these people are. You know, having Douglas Dross and I think it was Willie Rennie on. I mean, you know, it's basically a gift. the referee and Silly Willie, a gift to the national movement. I mean, interviews from that pair are a boost for independence in the opinion polls. But if you actually ever came to a conclusion where you had competent opposition leaders in Scotland, whereas, you know, Ruth Davidson, for all her weaknesses in terms of her inability to stick at the task, as opposed to going off to the House of Lords, etc., But if you had somebody who was semi-competent like Ruth Davidson, taking advantage of such three hits in the media, then you'd be in real trouble. The only reason the SNP is not in real trouble is the fundamental total incompetence of ragtag and bobtail.
Agreed. But despite all that, despite all of that and all the obstacles they put in front of the ALAPA party, the message is getting through, Alec.
I believe it is. I think we're getting through at grassroots level. I was interested, there's a video which hopefully will be go viral, because it should do, because I was absolutely and utterly, completely immersed in a monsoon descending from the heavens above Lithgow. I was talking to this guy in Preston Crescent, who was telling me that his son had been talking to him about ALAPA. And I thought that was really interesting. He said, you know, my boy's voting for ALAPA. He says, you know, he's talking to me about it that night, you know. He says, you used to stay around here. And I said, yeah, just doing there at 101 Preston Road. And he's talking away about what his boy had said to him. I thought to myself, now, if you got to the stage that the parents are telling you on the doorstep that their boy's been speaking to them about ALAPA, then you're getting through.
Oh, for sure. I mean, the anecdotal stuff I'm getting from throughout the country is, you know, whenever ALAPA people are seen out on the street, there's horns tooting and lights flashing and people waving from their windows. Just like when the, and it goes back to the first conversation I had with you, it's just like the All Under One Banner marches, or at the time of 2014, where when you were marching down the street, everyone was waving at you and getting caught up in the moment. And that seems to be happening.
Yes, I think there's a genuine public resonance. And you know, we'll see what this week brings. But I'm hoping that's where Scotland is at the present moment. So, I mean, I think this election is pivotal in terms of where Scotland goes. I believe it. I mean, you know, obviously I'm voting SNP. I've voted SNP in my postal ballot. I've done that already. And I'm hoping that they get a lot of constituency seats. But I know that if we want to see a drive to independence, it depends on having an ALAPA beachhead in the Scots Parliament. That's what's going to determine whether or not the case for independence has progressed with sufficient urgency.
And when you've been out there, you know, bumping into the people, what have been the main concerns that they've been sort of relaying to you, apart from the usual bins and buses?
People are anxious about what's to come, you know, where we're going to go and what's going to happen with the economy. I mean, there's been a lot less anxiety about COVID because, you know, people feel that it's under control and it's, you know, coming out of it. I mean, I have to say, I think to some extent, I mean, my own view is that they should be extraordinarily cautious about variants coming from elsewhere. You know, I've done a lot of programs on coronavirus over the last, 15 months and now, and one thing I've learned is that this is a virus of huge adaptability. This is something that if you lower your guard, it hits you with a venom. I wouldn't be lowering my guard in terms of external importation of variants at the present moment. I would be getting it locked down, and if we're getting other countries vaccinated as quickly as we can. I mean, I just, you know, if this thing is allowed to come back in different form, it will. Mm-hmm. But people are generally speaking that they're emerging from that and they're starting to wonder what comes next, and that they're starting to think about, you know, blinking into the sunlight. And they want to hear. And I suppose there is a great thirst for, you know, people want, on one hand, they want life to go back to normal. On the other hand, they want things to be different and better than they were. It's quite an interesting combination, that. But I'll tell you something, there's a huge receptiveness among independence supporters for the idea we should just go on with it. And from everybody, independent supporters and non-independent supporters, there's a great wish to shake things up. I mean, there's a feeling that it's time for politicians to stand up their hind legs and start barking for Scotland.
Absolutely. But I mean, with so much negativity and bias round about, how do you manage? I mean, I know you love positive campaign. It's what you told us all in 2014, and we listened, and it was successful. I know you're someone who liked positive campaign. That's your message again this time. But it must be difficult sometimes to stay positive with so much negativity and bile round about you.
Not really. I mean, I love the argument for Scotland. I mean, I love the argument about, I mean, for example, Jim Walker produced the debt and asset paper today. I mean, I love nothing better than that. I it was quite interesting. I'm trying to remember his name now. Hold on just a second. The journalist used to be Newsnight. He's now working for Daily Mail. He turned up with a camera crew today and started asking me about not taking Sterling liabilities, and I love nothing better than explaining the sense and logic of the position. I mean, we offered them a deal back in 2014 and they flung it in our face. And therefore the idea we should do the same thing again is the definition of madness. You had your chance, and now is a different era and a different time. And so the case for Scotland, the case for what you should do, the case for how you get independence, the strategic thinking that's necessary, I just love that stuff. The rest of politics, you know, to me, doesn't really matter. I mean, the Scottish press corps, well, you know my feelings on the vast bulk of the Scottish press corps with a few honourable exceptions. Basically, they would have slept through the Sermon on the Mount. they're totally incapable in the main, and there are exceptions, but they're totally incapable of grasping any issue or reading more than two paragraphs of wanting to see and do anything apart from, you know, sit in front of their computer screens and see who's made a mistake in the latest tweet or some nonsense like that. I mean, that to them is politics. It's got nothing to do with politics. Absolutely nothing. And the people know it. They absolutely know it. And that's one of the reasons that the mainstream press is dying. And the alternative media and the social media and the online contributions are rising.
Absolutely.
Like the Alibaba.
I tend to call them a fifth column as opposed to a fourth estate.
Well, I couldn't possibly do that. It would be salmoned outrage and fifth column attack or some nonsense. I keep calling them the fourth estate. I mean, you know, people should be proud of being in the fourth estate.
Should.
I mean, you think about it for a second. You know, what greater privilege can there be than to be freely available to write commentaries on the human condition?
Indeed.
I mean, you know, that I mean, you know, that should be one of the greatest privileges of all. And it is amazing to me that so many people have so little appreciation of the privilege that they've been given to be able to do that. Now, of course, I mean, look, some people are fine journalists. I mean, I'm sure there are fine journalists in the BBC, but they're trapped organization which is fundamentally for purpose, and therefore it's difficult to express themselves. They're in a bureaucratic trap of some kind, but you know, there are many people who have given up and trying to do anything other than produce and wrote copy for their wannabe pension, the words that they believe their paper wants to have, regardless how ludicrous they become. And you know, a lot of journalists of my knowledge, they mock the Daily Express. You know, they say whatever paper they work for, at least I'm no work for the Daily Express, and have to produce, you know, complete and utter guff on their online and printed editions. But it's a lack of self-awareness. I mean, these papers, I mean, the Herald, for example, you know, an outstanding paper historically, with outstanding editors in living memory, who still has some outstanding columnists, to be fair. But in terms of its news output, it's absurd. It's not even a disgrace, it's just absurd. It's not even a a pale shadow of its former self. It's the inverse of its former self. Let me be quite clear. I prefer the old newspaper as the Glasgow Herald, when it was a solidly unionist paper of decent, than the Herald, actually, out with its excellent columnists, virtually no journalism at all.
Bring back Ian Bell. We miss him so much.
Well, indeed. I mean, there's a great loss to everyone. And but then columnists are not the problem, incidentally. And in a wider sense, you know, there's one or two idiots, of course, but then there always are in any profession. But by and large, the columnists are still reasonable in Scottish newspapers. It's probably their saving grace, actually. What's missing is just the... I mean, I knew a guy's dead now, unfortunately, David Perry, who I knew for many years as the Thompson Regional person in the House of Commons, the main person for the Press and Journal, for example. And David Perry, a lobby journalist over many years, that's the guy you want. That's the guy who reported the news and had the ability to summarise what had happened in a parliamentary debate or a parliamentary incident or a parliamentary proposal or something that was happening, had the ability to summarise it quickly, accurately, make it lively, understandable to his readership without any hint of bias or presentational tricks, who was actually prepared to do the work, to get the quotes, to research the issue. The sort of guy used to go in his Christmas holidays to Kew Gardens to see what was being revealed under the 30-year rule, not to get the press release on Hogmanay, but actually went to Kew Gardens to look at the files to find out what was there in the press release. I mean, you think to yourself, maybe it's just a question of personnel. You kind of get enough journalists. There's only a few journalists left, but you think to yourself, where are the David Perrys of this world? Where are the real journalists? You know, people who, if something was in David Perry's copy, you knew it was true. And if it wasn't true, then you'd read a correction willingly made within a few days.
Correct. Well, I'm old enough to remember if you heard something on the BBC or it was written in the Times of London, then you could believe it. Not now.
Well, you mean the Times? So that's the paper who believes or was willing to report the Henry Jackson Society, you know, a collection of actually, I describe them zealots at best, nutcases at worst. You know, people who decide that Iran is trying to dictate the independence debate in Scotland, and that is a front page story.
Yep.
These people.
It's These are
not journalists.
No,
the recyclers of nonsense.
Correct. The day Murdoch got his hands on it, it was finished. That was it. Over.
Let's be fair. I mean, I hear all this about, you know, the evils of the Murdoch Empire. Of course, it's absolutely true that the journalists who take the Murdoch shilling are willing to tut at other people. But I don't know. I mean, do you think that Rupert Murdoch actually instructed a journalist to write nonsense about the Henry Jackson Society in Iran? No, I think to a great extent people build their own prisons. They think they now write for the Times. Well, once upon a time, if you wrote for the Times, then you'd have thought it was your obligation to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Now I think if you write for the Times, you think any sensationalism, anything goes, basically. But does that come from an editorial instruction, or does it just come from the people who just want to keep themselves in a job and are lazy and just want to put some trite lines that they hope people will believe? In any event, it doesn't really matter because it's dying out. In a few years, it'll all be gone. And then all that will remain is people on a Scottish prism reminiscing about what it used to be like.
Correct, when I have my empire. I know you're a very busy man. I don't want to take forever with you. But this is the most you know, there's never been an election like this before anywhere, because in Scotland or in the UK, because of the COVID, et cetera, et cetera. And even for yourself, over and above that, I mean, you've been with the SNP all those years, but this is to start a new party and be fighting from the real bottom of the ring, even lower than in the days of the SNP, from nothing, from scratch. It must have been, well, exciting, but it must be different, Alec, to what you're used to.
Well, it's a bit of a throwback, you know. I was reminiscing today with someone. I was speaking to Les Huckfield, the former Labour minister who was backing Alapa today. And Les, a real nice guy, interesting guy. We're chatting over a coffee in the Scotsman bar. And I was saying, you know, it reminds me a bit of when I became publicity vice convener of the Scottish National Party in 1986. And I did a survey of the previous month reporting Scotland. And I found that the SNP had got one mention, and that was Gordon Wilson's cold climate bill. And so I decided there and then that I thought we'd better up the ante before the 1987 election. So I embarked on a scheme by which I claimed that Plaid Cymru and the SNP together would have 9 seats and hold the balance of power and suspend Westminster on a Scottish and Welsh rope. And it was rather exaggerated. I wouldn't describe it as nonsense, but it was certainly exaggerated. But the press bought it, hook, line and sinker. So, but the point I was making was, you had to sit there and say, well, we're getting no coverage at all, nobody cares, you know, what's it all about? Or we could try and make ourselves relevant. And it just reminds me a bit about Alapa at the present moment. It's a wee bit like that. You know, you have to... There you are, banned from broadcasting by the BBC. And therefore you have to think of innovative initiatives. I mean, our Digivan, which is touring Scotland at the present moment, well, I think we've got 3 on the go just now. You know, we're now broadcasting direct to the village halls. It's like a mobile cinema, yep, as opposed to relying on reporting Scotland.
So, there's only a few days to go. We're in the last lap. It's been the quickest election I can ever remember. What will you do in the remaining days?
Well, today I was getting drunk, as I've told you. Mm-hmm. And tomorrow I'm going to do my last press conference of the campaign. I'm then going to do a seminar for international investors with Jim Walker to tell them why Scotland is actually an excellent bet for an investment, because I think somebody should tell them that, and why I think that's the case, and why constitutional change will be a fillip to that investment. And then I'm coming down because the BBC, you know, how shall I put it, under pressure, have decided to interview me just before EastEnders. So I'm getting 7 minutes just before EastEnders, where I think the audience might be greater than in the debate they're keeping me out of, but they're interviewing me about the debate. So before it happens. So I shall have a few choice words for the BBC. They maybe get more than they bargained for.
Well, I look forward to that.
When they made the offer, but I tell you this: nothing will ever remove from my heart the anger that a public service broadcaster, which takes the people's money, which takes pensioners' money, and has a solemn duty to try and reflect. And allow democratic discourse in a country. That's why they've got a position of such privilege. So abysmally, totally, cynically, absolutely fails in its cardinal duty. The BBC have lost any right whatsoever to be considered even as a candidate to be a public sector broadcaster in Scotland. They should shuffle off in shame to whatever redoubt they can possibly find, and count themselves lucky that they are not generally regarded in the stocks as people who have totally abused, cynically abused their power. as I said, it's not about individual journalists. It's about the management, the apparatchiks, self-centered conceit and arrogance of an organisation which is long past its sell-by date. I mean, to speak nation unto nation was what Lord Reef said. This is an organisation which won't allow a nation to speak unto itself, never mind to anybody else. It's time to call time on the BBC, and if Thalapa are successful, as I hope we are, this week, I'm going to intend to make sure the BBC apparatchik spend the next 5 years in an inquest into the total collapse and failure that they have as a public service broadcaster.
When the Day of Independence comes, if God still spares me, I'll be quite delighted if you want. I'll go and hand out the P45s. Quite happy to go and willing to do that down at Pacific Quay when the time comes. A couple of quick last questions. So that's what you're going to do. What would you like the supporters of Alapa to be doing between now and Thursday?
Well, do what I'm going to do on Wednesday, which I'm touring my old constituency in Banff and Buchan. And we've got the Buchan Initiative. We're rallying in Stricken Community Park at 10 o'clock, 2 o'clock and 6 o'clock in three waves of canvassing. And we're going to do the entire Buchan villages. We're going to do Peterhead, Fraserburgh, Rose Harty, even into St Combs. We're going to do the lot. And we're going to galvanise as many votes as we can. Now, what I expect Alapa supporters to be doing, the Length and Breadth of Scotland, is exactly that. Making as much noise as possible, getting as noticed as possible, making up the ground for what we don't have in the airwaves, to show people in the streets and communities that there's only one party out working, and that is Alapa, which is rising.
Absolutely, it's rising. And on that, Ali, just as a final question, one thing I've seen coming through in social media quite a lot of certain concerns or maybe worries with people, but irrespective of the result that comes through on Saturday, and I am actually very optimistic about that. What happens next for Alapa? They're not going to go away. We're here to stay. So what's next for Alapa? After the success of this election, there will be all sorts of other things happening, yes? Alapa will be staying around.
Yeah, so there's no intention for Alapa to go back of the bus and keep quiet. Alapa will stay at the front of the bus. We've got a big role. That role can develop in many ways, but it's certainly going to develop. I think a parliamentary bridgehead will fundamentally change the timescale for Scottish independence, fundamentally change it, because the SNP won't be able to backslide if Alapa are successful. Even if they wanted to, then they won't be able to. That's the old story that Gordon Wilson once told me about a conversation he had with Harold Wilson in 1974. Harold Wilson, the Prime Minister of the Labour minority government, elected in February 1974, the SNP with 7 seats. Harold Wilson, who is one of my great heroes, incidentally, but stopped Gordon Wilson in the members' lobby. And Gordon was really excited to be talked to by the Prime Minister. And Harold Wilson wished Scotland well in the World Cup. And Gordon said, well, that's great, but you didn't stop me to talk about the World Cup. And Harold Wilson said, no, I was just wondering how you and your colleagues were settling in, the 7 of you. And Gordon says, you must be pretty worried about what we're going to do. You were a minority government and votes coming up. And Harold Wilson said, no, I'm not in the slightest worried. He said, the things I'm putting forward, you wouldn't dare vote against, even if you wanted to. He said, mind you, I am a bit worried about the 36 second places in Labour seats across Scotland. That's what worries me. Yeah. Well, it's a bit like that with Alapa, isn't it? If we get a bridgehead, then it'll make sure that the independence case is carried forward for alacrity and urgency, because if it's not, it'll be all the other seats, all the other things to come, all the other activists, all the other MPs and MSPs who might say, well, it's time to cross the floor because Alapa is here and Alapa is rising.
Absolutely. On that very optimistic note, can I thank you, Alec, for spending some time with Through a Scottish Prism. We greatly appreciate it. And when all this is over, I'll look forward to speaking to you again and catching up.
Pleasure.
And you take care. And I'll look forward to speaking to you when you're victorious at the weekend.
Shala. Bye for now, Roddy.
Bye, Alec.
Through a Scottish Prism, the programme that is unapologetically pro-Scottish independence and anti-Westminster rule. Everything we say here is viewed through a Scottish prism. Brought to you by Barhead Boy.